the opposite from Benjamin, and as Benjamin's chest and arms became wood, her head and neck and shoulders became wood.
El Niño, José cried.
He did not mean the dragon-scaled child, but rather the infant that the now wooden Loyola had been carrying. As Antonia began to scream Loyola's name, the sound swirling away in the powder, José seized a shovel and leaped forward to chop Daniel's small body out of the now wooden Loyola before he was sealed in forever. Even as José hacked at Loyola's lifeless form, his own legs became wood from this interference. He shouted for his brothers to leave him. Francisco and Michael and Rosa dragged Antonia into the house and slammed the door. The fox ran away, and so did the dragon-scaled boy. It was only after the sounds of destruction had died away that Antonia, Francisco, Michael, and Rosa reemerged. José's sacrifice had worked. The baby Daniel had been hewn from his wooden mother and now sobbed in the dust beside his wooden father and wooden uncle. He was fully flesh and blood and untouched by the darkness. As a helpless newborn, he had no way to accidentally interfere with his parents' or uncle's miracle, and moreover, as an innocent infant, he had no darkness inside him yet to be provoked by such a disaster. Rosa lifted Daniel from the wooden remains of his family. Antonia touched the place where Loyola's wooden frame had been cleaved to remove him. Francisco took the shovel from where it had fallen beside José and leaned it back up against the house. He did not say anything. This was when Antonia became angry, and she had never become unangry since. This was also when Francisco began to use fewer and fewer words each year. Michael stopped cutting his hair. Rosa remained Rosa. Antonia finished telling this story as she led the cousins toward a small shed by the chickens. The door was barred and never opened, but she opened it now. The light sprawled over the dust inside. She threw her hand outward to demonstrate the contents of the shed. She said, "And there they still are today."
"That just looks like wood," Joaquin said.
"Exactly," replied Antonia.
"But Loyola was not a Soria," Beatriz pointed out. "Why wasn't she allowed to help Benjamin?"
"If you love a Soria, their darkness is yours too," Antonia said.
"Hmm," said Beatriz.
They all peered at the pile of gray wood inside the shed for several long minutes. Beatriz was thinking it was fortunate that she had never opened the door before, as she would have thoughtlessly burned her relatives as firewood. Antonia was thinking that she was even angrier now than she was the day she lost her best friend. Joaquin was thinking that Daniel was only alive because of José's quick and selfless bravery. And now Daniel had been felled by the precise same thing that had claimed his parents. Judith was thinking about how she had never even considered that Eduardo was just as endangered now by the Soria taboo by virtue of his love for her. Francisco was thinking about how long it had taken them to decide on a name for his dead sister's baby, once they had removed him from the scene of the tale. They were all thinking about what Daniel's darkness might look like.
"If only we could train your dogs to take food to him," Beatriz said.
"Without killing him directly afterward," Joaquin murmured. Antonia snarled.
"In any case, that settles the issue of the birthday party for now," Francisco said finally. "I won't celebrate until Daniel returns to us."
Chapter 11. Pete worked. He began to work as soon as he tossed his bags into the room he was to share with Padre Jimenez, and he worked without pause all day long. He worked for 6 hours straight, pausing only to suddenly divert his path when he caught sight of Beatriz Soria, waiting until the coast was clear and his heart was safe, before he began work again.
"New boy,"
called Robbie, one of the twins who could not remember his name.
"Come talk to us."
Pete said, "I can't, I'm working."
"Pete?"
Marisita called as he walked through Bicho Raro, his arms full of boxes.
"Will you be stopping for almuerzo?"
Pete said, "I can't, I'm working."
"You're making me tired to look at you," said Mossy Theldon from his seat on the porch. "Take a load off."
Pete said, "I can't, I'm working." Antonia had set Pete on tasks that required little skill but much sweat. Pete found himself digging out collapsed irrigation ditches and picking individual nails out of the driveway, sweeping unoccupied and sometimes occupied wasp nests out of eaves, and plucking malevolently red Colorado potato beetle larvae off the tomato and potato crops. The last of these tasks nearly broke him. As relentless as Pete was, the Colorado potato beetle was more so. As fast as he could destroy them, they made more of themselves. He did not know that the Colorado potato beetle, also known as the ten-lined potato beetle, was also currently persecuting the East Germans. Plagues of potato beetles were blamed upon American plains. Communist propaganda shouted that the Sex by Nigger Botschafter del Wall Street, six-legged ambassadors of Wall Street, would eat them out of house and home and right into capitalism. East German schoolchildren were sent into the fields to pluck larvae, just as Pete was doing, and they too learned to hate the small, fleshy, scarlet creatures. It was possible that this particularly unwinnable game might have broken Pete's will to work, but luckily for him, a thunderstorm came in, fast and roaring. The desert caught his attention with a puff of dust and weeds, so he just had time to take cover in the six-stall barn before the rain really began to come down. Inside the barn, Pete began to shovel manure and sweep the aisle. It was hard work, but it was better than the never-ending drudgery of beetle-picking. Inside, it was dim and comforting, either because of or despite Pete not being raised around horses. There were only two horses in the stable at the moment. Three, if you counted the one the mare was carrying inside her. But they were all terrible horses. The mare was a savage creature, kept mostly because she was the fastest barrel racer to come out of Colorado in a generation. She was so mean that she even killed her own name, and now people just pointed to her. They kept breeding her, hoping that she'd throw a foal with all the speed and none of the malice, but so far, no dice. They had great hopes for the foal she was carrying now, but the truth was that the tiny filly inside her would, in 6 years, bear the state's current barrel racing champion out of a competition and through the display window of a local furniture store. The other horse in the barn was Salto, a saddle-bred stallion that one of the pilgrims had come riding in on 5 years before. He was a very fancy horse, it turned out, one of the last of a very rare bloodline. And so although the Sorias were not particularly interested in saddlebreds, he was nonetheless valuable for his progeny. Every so often people would come from very far away to breed their mares to him and would pay an enormous sum for this privilege. And so he remained. The only problem with Salto was that he was extremely high-strung and would not respect a fence. He had to remain in his box stall day in and day out, and as he was so anxious and excitable, he had to wear a small bit of padding strapped between his ears to prevent him from rearing up and murdering himself on the ceiling of his own stall. Michael had put a radio in the stable to soothe Salto and prevent him from attempting escape. Pete was looking at Salto when he realized that he was not the only human in the barn. There was another man scrubbing buckets in one of the empty stalls. To break the silence, and to be friendly, Pete said,
"Crazy weather, right?"
Pete did not know it, but he was talking to Luis the One-Handed, who was not actually one-handed, but was called that because his left hand was a full 1 inch wider than his right. Luis used the spread of those left fingers to great advantage. He was the finest guitar player in a 50-mile radius, and no one could catch a baseball like he could. There were two things that people did not know about Luis. First, that he was a collector of gloves. He bought 2 pairs of gloves each time, as he needed 2 different sizes, and he kept the 2 small left gloves in a box that he stored between his mattress and the wall. Second, Luis, the One-Handed, was a great romantic, and he daydreamed that there existed a love of his life who also had mismatched hands, and that his useless left-hand gloves would one day fit her. So he kept those gloves in a box, like a stack of pre-written love letters, waiting for the heart that was longing to read them.
"It's a big change from Oklahoma," Pete tried.
"Llueve a cántaros," said Luis.
This exchange was unproductive, as Luis the One-Handed did not speak very good English, and Pete was from Oklahoma and had only loneliness as his second language. They both shrugged, and, his bucket scrubbing done, Luis went into the hayloft to nap until the rain was over. So Pete worked with only the galloping rain on the roof for company. He was happier than he'd been in a while. Although homesickness still plucked at him, his overall mood had been so poor in the days leading up to his exodus from Oklahoma that everything else seemed brighter in comparison. It would be easy to think that the reason Pete's failure to serve hit him so hard was because his family wasn't understanding. But the truth was the opposite. If one lives with a brood of ogres, it is not a hard thing at all to let them down. One can even feel, perhaps, that the ogres had it coming. They were ogres, after all. But the Wyatts were not ogres. George Wyatt was a brusque and realistic man, but he was not cruel. He eyed the situation at hand and took the steps needed to correct for it. When Pete, the doctor, handed Pete the son back to him with the verdict of unfit for service, he surveyed the situation and told Pete, factually, that Pete would find something else to do, and in any case he was sure that Dexter would continue the family's military legacy, so Pete didn't have to feel he was letting down the home front. Floor Wyatt, Pete's mother, was married to a military man, and her mother had been married to a military man, and her mother's mother had been married to a military man, and even back in Spain her mother's mother had been married to a military man, and so on and so forth until the beginning of both women and the military. But she did not shame Pete's inability to enlist. Instead, she said,
"I'm sure you'll find another way to serve your country."
And Dexter Wyatt, Pete's slightly younger brother, who was the closest to an ogre the Wyatt family had, said,
"I'll shoot him for you, Pete."
This kindness, however, only made the situation worse for Pete. It emphasized that the person who was being cruelest to Pete was actually Pete. He knew that leaving wouldn't change the way he felt. He didn't pretend that he would outrun himself. But he did think he might find something to feed that voracious sense of duty inside him. Unless that hungry feeling was just the gaping hole in his heart. The box truck, he thought, had to be the answer. Pete peered at the vehicle as he worked in the barn, looking out the windows to where it was parked at every opportunity. It was a touchstone, reminding him of what all of his new blisters would eventually be traded for. He thought he saw the back of the truck open at one point, but when he looked back out the window, it was closed again. After a few hours of work, Pete realized that there were sounds coming from within the barn that could not be accounted for by the storm, the horses, or Luis's snores. Following the sounds to their source, he discovered a low crawl space with a door in it. On the other side of the door, standing in the rain, was Michael Soria, Joaquin's father. Michael was working. He had not yet been told about Daniel, but even if he had been, he would have still been working. Ever since he had lost so much of his family to the incident with the German and the child, all he did was work from the moment he opened his eyes until the moment he closed them, taking his meals standing up, and saving all of his non-negotiable body functions for the 2 minutes before he retired to bed. He was a very old-fashioned kind of person. Many people mistook Michael for Joaquin's grandfather. He had already been quite old when he had children, and he appeared even older than he was because of his beard. Ever since the incident with the German and the child, he had stopped cutting both his hair and his beard, and instead allowed them to grow as long as they wanted. Now, both were so long that he had to wrap each up into a knot he secured with bands, one at the nape of his neck, and one at his chin. Because his bones troubled him so much from all of his age and all of his work, he would unknot his beard and hair when he climbed into bed, and, spreading it out, he would lie on top of it and find that it was the only thing that eased his aches and pains. Here was a thing he wanted. To work. Here was a thing he feared. That he would become too feeble to work. When Pete heard Michael, he was repairing the barn foundation in the rain. A scourge of pocket gophers had arrived at the beginning of the year with only two purposes: to make more pocket gophers and to dig their home directly beneath the barn. They had been so successful in the first pursuit that Antonia's dogs could now subsist entirely on a diet of slow pocket gophers. And they had been so successful with the second pursuit that the barn foundation now tipped precariously, weakened by a network of gopher sitting rooms. Michael had previously performed a temporary repair by filling the holes with Rosa's failed, rock-hard milk cakes, but the holes had outgrown Rosa's baking habit, and now he had no choice but to rebuild it properly. Pete surveyed the situation and formed an opinion. Need a hand? Michael surveyed Pete and formed an opinion.
It's raining.
Yes, sir, Pete agreed. He joined Michael in the rain, and together they worked side by side until their clothing was as soaked through as Marisita's. They reached the end of the section Michael had hoped to finish that day, and wordlessly they began the next. They finished the next day's section, and began on the next. And so on and so forth, until they had repaired the entirety of the barn's foundation, and it had stopped raining, and the sun had come back out again, and they both stopped to rest their hands on their knees and look at what they had done.
"You're Josefa's boy," Michael said finally.
"Nephew, sir."
"You're here about the truck?"
"Yes, sir."
"Good,"
said Michael, which might not seem like much of a reply, but put together was more than he'd said to most anyone for years.
"Sir, do you mind me asking?" Pete began. "Do folks mostly come here for miracles?"
"Why else would they come out here?"
This statement was not as dour as it sounded. Beatriz was not the only one in Bichoraro who could be strictly pragmatic. Pete gestured to the land around them.
"Because it's pretty."
The desert preened, and Michael regarded Pete anew. One compliments a man when one compliments his chosen home, and Michael felt nearly as good as the desert about Pete's words. Kindly, he said,
"You better get into some dry clothes now."
Straightening up, Pete finger-combed his rain-flat hair into its usual style.
"Soon. Gotta pick some beetles first. See you later, sir."
He left Michael standing there by the side of the barn, shearing off hard left to avoid a shadow he thought might be Beatrice, and then threw himself back into beetle-picking. Ordinarily, Michael would have also thrown himself directly back into work, but for the first time in a very long time, Michael stood there for a full 5 minutes before beginning his next job, just watching Pete start on his next project. Humans have always been fascinated by mirrors, after all. Michael had never seen from the outside how it looked to work constantly to avoid feeling, and he could not look away. Chapter 12. That night, Beatrice and Joaquin went out in the box truck with a renewed purpose. Before, the identity of their desired audience had been nebulous, distant. Now, in light of the day's events, all of their audience was wrapped up in a single person. Daniel Lupe Soria, their beloved cousin. Daniel Lupe Soria, their cherished saint. Daniel Lupe Soria, lost in darkness.
"This one goes out to Daniel if he's listening," said Diablo Diablo. "Some light for your darkness. This is There's a Moon Out Tonight by the Capris."
"There's a Moon Out Tonight" began to croon, although there was no moon out that night. Diablo Diablo's pre-taped voice remained inside the back of the box truck as Joaquin, the body of Diablo Diablo, sat in the cab of the truck with Beatrice, listening. Joaquin was torn every which way inside. He was a passionate person, but not good at being passionate at more than one thing at a time. On the one hand, he was thinking about Daniel's plight. Joaquin had always admired Daniel. He did not want to be him, as all of the praying and holiness seemed as if it would conflict with Joaquin's sense of panache, but he deeply appreciated everything his cousin stood for and all of the kindnesses Daniel had ever shown him. It seemed to Joaquin now, in misty and faulty retrospect, that Daniel was soft and vulnerable, too kindly to protect himself, a saint made for martyring. He could not imagine how the older Sorias could live with themselves, knowing that Daniel was out in the desert alone. Where was their courage? But this was not all that Joaquin was thinking about. It felt unfair to his cousin to be anything but consumed by thoughts of him. And yet, Joaquin was also guiltily thinking about the radio. Joaquin had long been obsessed with radio personalities and modern music. He listened to Denver's KLZ FM with both resentment and hope, comparing himself to the local personalities and measuring if he could do better. He listened to the wild howl of the Border Blasters DJs, those cowboys of the high-powered stations that screamed out from just across the Mexican border, skirting American regulations through sheer force of power. And, signal permitting, he listened to the sweet, fast patter of the more famous personalities of the time, like Jocko Henderson and High Lit. He was an ardent follower of American Bandstand, that daytime Philadelphia-based television show featuring teens dancing to the latest hits. The Sorias did not have a television, so twice a week, Joaquin rode into town with Luis and watched it on Elmer Farkas' television before hitching a ride back home, an arrangement that had been established during the school year and had not yet expired. This program formed the basis for most of Joaquin's hair and clothing decisions. He studied the screen diligently for evidence of fashions that had yet to reach southern Colorado, most never would, and did his credible best to duplicate them. For this progressive attitude, he received considerable ridicule from his family, which he never appeared to notice, although he did. He dreamed of a day when he would be infamous behind the microphone, Diablo Diablo, devil of the airwaves, and teens would be looking to him to set trends. Joaquin tried to make himself think only about Daniel, but here in the box truck, the radio could not help but intrude. Beatrice, however, had only one thought in her head. This was unusual, because she was ordinarily likely to hold many thoughts in her head, and, unlike Joaquin, was good at it. The one thought was Pete Wyatt. Over the course of the day, Beatrice had learned that Pete, he of the potentially soft elbow skin, was in Pichoraro to work for the very same truck they were sitting in now. Her first impression had been that this deal wasn't fair, which she almost immediately rejected as her personal bias, and then revisited when she considered that actually, after a consultation with the facts, it really wasn't fair. The truck, after all, had been a wreck before this summer, overgrown and inoperable, and Beatrice had spent many long hours restoring it to life. Surely that gave her some claim to it. She didn't blame Pete for this conundrum. He could not have known before making the work arrangement that Beatrice was going to restore the truck. But it didn't erase the conflict. It would not have mattered if the truck hadn't been their only way to communicate with Danielle. Annoyed at the impasse, she opened the passenger door. "Where are you going?" Joaquin asked. "I'm checking the range." During the course of the afternoon, Beatrice had double-checked her soldering job on each connection. This was when Pete had glimpsed her earlier. Although there was no way to find out if Danielle and the kitchen radio were anywhere within the listening radius, she could at least do her best to cast the signal as far as possible. Both cousins were desperate to communicate with him safely. They had their ideas of what he might be doing at that moment. Although it defied his sense of nobility, Joaquin imagined Danielle huddled in a grotto, like a caveman, gnawing on the desiccated leg of a kangaroo rat, his clothing already tattered rags. Although it defied Beatrice's sense of probability, she imagined Danielle padding silently across the dusty desert, his form the opposite of Padre Jimenez's, the body of a coyote, the head of a man. With a shiver, Joaquin removed the keys from the ignition. He didn't want to stay in the truck by himself. There was something more ominous about being in a dark vehicle alone than being in the dark night with Beatrice. He made sure to snatch a bottle of water, lest he dry out in the desert. He put it inside his shirt. And also the flashlight. He did not put it inside his shirt. Beatrice had already climbed from the truck with a radio in hand. Because Danielle had taken the kitchen Motorola, they had taken the only other radio that was in Pichoraro. This was the one Pete had heard playing in the barn earlier. Joaquin had been anxious that the horses would somehow stampede without the benefit of the radio static, but Beatrice had considered the likelihood of that and found the odds acceptable. Statistically, the horses had never stampeded in her lifetime. Factually, it was impossible for the radio to have been playing programming for all of those hours. Statistically, the horses would not stampede in her lifetime. Factually, the cousins would be fine to take it for a few hours. Beatrice also carried a shotgun. She did not think she would have to use it. But the world seemed like a more dangerous place than it had only a few days before. "Joaquin," she ordered, "please point that flashlight where we're going." Joaquin was caught equally between a fear of invisible wild animals and detection by the FCC, and so he alternately pointed the light where they were walking, and into his palm when he felt they were too obvious to prying distant eyes. "I heard that sometimes Soria darkness will attack other Sorias, even without interference." "All the more reason to see it coming. Who told you that?"
"Nana."
"I don't believe you."
"Okay," Joaquin admitted. "It's just this. I saw Mama tell her about Danielle, and Nana immediately got up and locked her back door. What do you think about that?"
Grudgingly, Beatrice had to admit that Joaquin's thesis was not a bad one.
Joaquin made a triumphant noise, not in keeping with secrecy.
If you're going to shout, you might as well point the flashlight so we can see,
Beatrice ordered. Distant thunder made them pause. Joaquin ran an anxious hand over his hair and cast an anxious glance at the sky.
Are we going to be killed?
Unlikely,
Beatrice replied. Although the sky above them was clear, lightning was visible on the horizon. A storm, many dozens of miles away. In a place as flat as this high desert, weather was often something that happened to other people. Beatrice was not particularly worried about being struck by that storm's lightning, although she did devote a passing thought to the antenna connected to the box truck. They would turn back to take it down if this storm got too close. A lightning strike would be potentially deadly to the station.
Can we make the signal stop crackling like that?
Joaquin asked.
Not tonight,
Beatrice replied.
It needs more work.
This reminded her of Pete Wyatt, and how she was not at all sure how much more time she had with the truck. She felt obliged to tell Joaquin all of this, and did, in a low voice, so that she could still have one ear on the signal strength. After she was through, Joaquin kicked the dirt, but not hard because he didn't want to dirty his paisley pants, and he also cursed a little. Pete Wyatt? Joaquin didn't know much about Pete Wyatt, but he was not a fan. This had nothing to do with Pete Wyatt and everything to do with Michael, who had actually stopped working in order to sing the praises of Pete's work ethic to Rosa and Joaquin. He began with small gestures, complimenting Pete's quick ability to grasp the meat of any new job, and then moved out from there to admiring how hard Pete worked even under the harsh rain, expanded further to how satisfying it was to see a young person who actually appreciated the land, and then ultimately ending up with a somewhat tone-deaf statement that Pete was the son every man deserved but never had. Joaquin, as the son that Michael may not have deserved but definitely actually had, was less than thrilled by the statements. His mother Rosa defended Joaquin, but not in a way that brought Joaquin any satisfaction.
If only Joaquin could bring himself to work at anything like Wyatt does, Michael said.
Oh, you know Kino, Rosa replied. He is a gentle boy and he will come into his own one day.
When I was Joaquin's age, I knew what I wanted to do with myself, and that was leave a print on the world with the dint of my labor, Michael said.
We need soft men, too. Sweet, gentle boys whose mothers love them just the way they are.
I never see Joaquin doing anything but oiling his hair. A man is more than his hair.
He is also his mustache, Rosa agreed. But Kino is still just a boy, and soon enough he will have a mustache. Not like yours, of course. You cannot expect that of anyone, even your own son. But he will have his own sort.
This infuriated Joaquin. He did not want to be a soft, gentle man who had accomplished nothing. He was not a soft, gentle man who had accomplished nothing. He longed to tell them that he already had plans, and that he was going to be a radio DJ, Diablo Diablo, and that one day they would compare Pete Wyatt to him and find Pete wanting.
I'll talk to him,
Beatrice said.
Pete, I mean.
What are you going to say?
I think that will depend on him.
Quick as death, Joaquin halted and held a hand out to Beatrice, snatching her to a standstill. Everyone has two faces, the one they wear, and the one that is beneath it. Joaquin, quite suddenly, wore the latter. Beatrice stopped. She gently lifted the shotgun. A desert is a lot like an ocean, if you replace all of the water with air. It stretches out and out and out in unfathomable distance, and, in the absence of sunlight, turns to pure black. Sounds become secrets, impossible to verify as true until the light returns. It is not empty merely because you cannot see all of it. And you know in your heart that it isn't, that it is the opposite of empty once it is dark, because things that do not like to be watched emerge when all of the light is gone. There is no way to know the shape of them, though, until your hand is on them. Something was there in the desert. The creature was moving slowly among the distant brush, dark against the night-purple horizon, nearly human-shaped. There was a rattling or hissing as it moved, like dry beans shaken gently in a pan. Joaquin was suddenly reminded of Nana locking her back door. Beatriz was suddenly reminded of long-lived Felipe Soria, wandering forever, looking for that femur-made cross, and of the furious businessman she had failed to help, tangled in his beard. Diablo Diablo said, "If there wasn't a moon out there before, there is one now. Coming up next, we've got something to put a smile on that moon's face." At the sound of his voice, the figure stopped. Every head turned toward the radio. It continued to prattle on in a way that we do not notice when we are not trying to be silent in the desert night. Diablo Diablo said, "The moon loves company, so get your teeth ready." The creature stepped toward them. It was difficult to terrify Beatriz Soria, for the same reason that it was difficult to get her angry. Fear and rage are not very different when you think about it. Two hungry animals that often hunt the same prey, emotion, and hide from the same predator, logic. So Beatrice's surfeit of logic usually protected her from terror. Although it easily delivered her to anxiety, anxiety was merely another brand of her usual considered thought, after all, just one that refused to go away when she asked it nicely or was trying to sleep. Beatrice's fear, though, required enough information to conclude that almost certainly something bad was going to happen, and also that the something bad was awful enough that it could not be easily remedied, and that rarely happened. So Beatrice was not afraid in this moment, but only because she didn't have enough information to be afraid. "The flashlight," she said, without taking her eyes from the figure. Joaquin did not require information to be afraid, and was accordingly out of his mind with fear. He managed to collect himself just enough to point the light directly at the intruder. Butterflies moved their wings slowly in the flashlight's beam. It was not Felipe Soria, nor Daniel's darkness. It was Marisita López. Marisita's ever-present wedding dress and the weighty bag upon her back had created the strange silhouette the cousins had spotted. The hissing sound was nothing but the sound of the raindrops dashing against the tumbleweed and brush around her. Joaquin recoiled. She was not a monster, but she was a pilgrim, and that was just as dangerous. Beatriz, however, scrutinized Marisita. This was the first time she had seen the young woman since reading Daniel's letter, and she was now trying to see Marisita through Daniel's eyes. As anything but a pilgrim, because Daniel must have seen past that to fall in love with her. Joaquin twisted his fingers in Beatriz's sleeve and tugged. But Beatriz lingered.
"Were you running away into the desert?"
"Beatriz," Joaquin hissed.
I am looking for Daniel, the saint," Marisita said. I couldn't imagine him out there without supplies."
This was what filled the overfilled bag she carried. Marisita had thought very hard about what Daniel might need, and had taken quite a long time to assemble it into the pack. Here was what she had brought. 10 cured sausages, a pot of cheese, 12 avocados, 3 oranges, 2 cups of lard, a small pile of tortillas, 4 tins of beans, cornmeal, a skillet,
100 matches, 3 pairs of dried socks, 4 clean shirts, a harmonica, a small blanket, a pocket knife, a paring knife, a votive candle, a hairbrush, a bar of soap, a notebook that was only halfway used up, a pen, 3 cigarettes, a sheep-collared coat, a cup for water, a pellet gun, a flashlight, and a small satchel of Francisco's rose petals in case Daniel needed to smell it in order to cure homesickness. The tenderness of this gesture finally provided Beatriz a window into Marisita's heart. For the first time, she began to see Marisita as not merely a pilgrim, but rather a person. And not just a person, but someone who showed her care for someone else in intensely practical ways. Joaquin, on the other hand, had reached the end of his stamina for uncertainty.
Beatriz, let's go! We can't be talking to her! This is madness! She could kill us both!
Marisita knew the taboo as well as Asoria, perhaps better, after the events of the night before. She was already ducking away as she said,
You should. I don't want something else terrible to happen. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to meet anyone tonight.
Wait, Beatriz said, although she did not yet know the words that were going to follow. The problem with ideas is that they never come all at once. They emerge like prairie dogs, an edge of ear or the tip of a nose, and sometimes even the whole head. But if you look straight at an idea too fast, it can vanish back into the ground before you're even sure of what you've seen. Instead, you have to sneak up on it slowly, looking out of the corner of your eye, and then, and only then, you might glance up to get a clear look. Beatriz was having an idea now, but she'd only seen an ear or a whisker.
Wait, echoed Joaquin. I have questions, Beatriz confessed.
Beatriz,
Joaquin exhorted.
She's the pilgrim Daniel helped, Beatriz told him. She's the last one to see him. This is Marisita.
Oh, said Joaquin.
There was a pregnant pause. An unusual and elegant intersection of needs and wants had formed in that moment, and they could all sense it. They all longed to talk to one another about their common interest, Daniel. As pressing as this urge was, if it had only been a desire for information, it might have died there. But there was something else. When Daniel had asked Beatriz if she ever thought they were doing it wrong, he had merely voiced an unspoken question both of them had been carrying for a while. For Daniel, it was because ethics pressed badly at him, with all of the pilgrims falling between the cracks. For Beatriz, it was the sense that the facts were being made to add up to something that was not quite true. All of these truths were being bundled together and sealed with superstition and fear instead of science and reason. Marisita lingered, but didn't speak. Beatriz's mind worked busily. Joaquin's mouth still held the shape of his last word. None of them knew precisely how far they could press this meeting. Before he'd moved into the greenhouse, Francisco would sometimes tell Beatriz stories of scientists, like Guillermo González Camarena, the teenage inventor of the color TV, or Elia Bravo Hollis, the botanist who'd catalogued hundreds of succulent plants and founded the Sociedad Mexicana de Cactología. These great minds organized facts in new ways and performed experiments on the accepted truth, changing one variable here or there to test just how factual their facts really were. Beatriz and Daniel had been eyeing the facts they'd been given for quite a while, though they'd had no way to test them. But now, Beatriz's thoughts moved to the radio, which was still noisy with Diablo Diablo's banter. It sounded as if they were still hearing Joaquin's voice, but really, it was not Joaquin at all. It was the sound of his voice encoded onto a signal, which the transmitter then modified so that the stable stolen radio could pick it up and play it from the speaker. It was no more Joaquin than a drawing of him would be him.
"What do you think about,"
Beatrice began. The prairie dog of an idea had lifted its head from the hole.
"Doing a radio interview."
Chapter 13. We don't quite understand miracles. This is the way of most divine things. Saints and miracles belong to a different world and use a different set of rules. It is hard to tell the human purpose of Saint Joseph of Cupertino's miraculous levitation, for instance. Whenever he was transported by faith, he was also transported by physics, often several feet into the air, sometimes in the middle of a homily. He would at times remain up there for hours, paused in mid-speech, while his fellow brothers waited for him to descend and finish his thought. It is also difficult to tell the usefulness of the miracles of St. Christina the Astonishing. After rising from the dead in her 20s, she would, upon occasion, hurl herself into a river and allow herself to be carried downstream into the path of a churning mill wheel. There she would be thrown in violent circles before emerging unscathed. A miracle. And then there was St. Anthony of Padua. His miracles were varied, all beyond understanding, but perhaps the most inscrutable was the miracle at the water's edge. Finding no human company to address, he preached at the water's edge so piously that a school of fish broke the surface to listen, a miracle difficult to understand, as fish have no souls to save and no voices to convert unbelievers. Compared to these, the Soria miracles were quite palatable. Yes, sometimes the pilgrims to Bichoraro became impossibly ugly or fearfully radiant, intensely practical or clumsily fanciful. Some grew feathers. Some shrank to the size of a mouse. Sometimes shadows came to life and scampered around the pilgrim. Sometimes wounds formed that refused to heal. But these oddities were no random punishments, but rather messages specific to each pilgrim. The darkness made flesh was a concrete puzzle that, if solved, provided the mental tools the pilgrim needed to move on. The intention of every Soria miracle was the same: to heal the mind. Daniel Soria had been telling himself this over and over since the night before. This trial was not a punishment, he reminded himself. This trial was a miracle. But it did not feel like a miracle. He was out in the high desert night, sitting cross-legged by a smoldering fire. Although it was very cold, it was a very small fire, because Daniel could not shake the image of Joaquin coming after him despite all warnings, and finding him by the light of the blaze. So he kept it near suffocated, and sat with his palms pressed against the still warm ground. It was so dark. Although he was curved into the small orange circle of light provided by a smoldering fire, everything he looked at appeared dull. He seemed to be having difficulty seeing light the same way he had this time yesterday. It was as if there was a gauzy curtain hung between his eyes and the fire, and two heavier curtains on either side of his vision threatening to close. It was possible, he thought, that they had already closed a little more since he had left Bichoraro. He did not know what he would do if he went blind out here in the wild scrub. He knew the miracles were meant to teach the pilgrims something about themselves. Take Tony, for instance, and his newfound gigantism. Daniel figured Tony was someone famous. He didn't recognize him personally, but he'd seen many celebrities come through Bichoraro, and he'd gotten pretty good at noting the posturing and style that marked public figures. So Tony,
suffering under the public eye, as most celebrities do, had received a miracle that ensured he was under even more constant scrutiny. The miracle's purpose was then clear. If Tony could learn to live as a giant, he would once again be able to live as a man. This meant that Daniel's narrowing vision was supposed to teach him something, but he didn't know what it might be. He had thought that he knew himself pretty well, and yet meaning eluded him. Perhaps this darkness was meant to teach him trust, or humility, or despair. Nothing seemed obvious. Possibly an outsider might have been able to immediately identify the truth of it, just as the meaning of Tony's darkness was obvious to Daniel. But there was no one else to observe Daniel, and he meant to keep it that way. Daniel tried not to devote too much time to the most hopeless outcome, which was that Daniel might discover what the darkness truly meant and still be unable to overcome it. He recalled a pilgrim from Utah, whose miracle had left him with a bulbous red face and a helpless desire to gag whenever he tried to put food in his mouth. The man seemed to understand at once what this darkness stood for, because he became overwhelmed with grief and guilt. Daniel, of course, had been unable to speak to him because of the taboo, and the pilgrim had disappeared into the desert overnight. Later, he was found dead. His face no longer red. The miracle had died with the pilgrim. The knowing had not helped him. Perhaps Daniel was meant to learn how difficult miracles were. No. He thought he knew that already. "If there wasn't a moon out tonight, there is one now," Diablo said. "Coming up next, we've got something to put a smile on that moon's face." The radio had managed to snatch the signal of his cousin's station, and though Daniel knew it would be as easy to die with the sound of Diablo playing as not, he preferred the company. It distracted him from the black at the corners of his vision, from the cold, and from the distinct feeling that he wasn't alone. There was something out there in the night, something that had drawn near as soon as he'd broken the taboo. Although he knew that it must be a concrete form of his own darkness, it didn't feel like an extension of himself. It felt like the concrete manifestation of the strangeness of this valley instead. Perhaps this was what was meant when they said that a saint's darkness was worse than an ordinary pilgrim's. Perhaps that was the reason why he couldn't find meaning in his miracle. Perhaps this was not healing darkness at all, but rather the opposite, a hellish entity sent to caper around and gobble up a fallen saint. He did not know if it was better or worse that the thing remained out of sight. Daniel mouthed a prayer. "Mother, ladies and gentlemen of the San Luis Valley," said Diablo, "we interrupt our normal broadcast for a live interview." Daniel's prayer silenced in his mouth. His hand with its spider eyes walked to the knob and turned up the volume. Static hissed in the background. Diablo continued, "This is our first interview, so excuse us mightily if we experience any technical difficulties. The first man to walk a road always has to clear a few rocks. Señorita, would you tell all our listeners at home your name? For your privacy, just your first name. We don't want anyone to stop you on the street and tell you your face is as pretty as your voice." Marisita said,
"Marisita?"
It was obvious now that the hissing in the background was not static after all. It was the patter of rain falling around Marisita. "Welcome to our show, Marisita."
"Marisita,"
Daniel said out loud, with wonder. Then, understanding what this meant, with worry.
"Joaquin."
Diablo continued, "Let me catch our listeners up on the situation, because you will not be able to understand Marisita's story unless you know about the saint of Bicho Raro.
Joaquin was not being entirely aspirational by suggesting they had an audience. Apart from Daniel, the station did actually have a few other listeners that night, including two long-distance truckers, a man in a farm truck 2 ranches over, an old woman with insomnia who was passing the time jarring cactus jelly while her 4 dogs watched her, and, by a twist of AM radio wave magic, a group of Swedish fishermen who had turned on the radio to listen to as they woke themselves up for their work of catching halibut.
"Imagine. You have a tormented mind," Diablo Diablo said, his voice dramatic. "You barter with sadness, or you fight with grief, or you eat arrogance every morning with your coffee. There are saints in this valley who can heal you. You and every other pilgrim can canter to Bicho Raro to receive a miracle."
"A miracle, you say?"
"A miracle. This miracle makes the darkness inside you visible in amazing and peculiar ways. Now that you see what has been haunting you, you overthrow it, and then you leave this place free and easy."
"Don't believe me?"
"Hey, hey, I don't make the news. I just report it." "There's only one catch. The saints cannot help you tackle your darkness after you receive the miracle, or they will bring darkness on themselves, a worse darkness than any ordinary man's."
"Or woman's, golly."
And now Daniel laughed out loud, helplessly, because he could hear the crack in Joaquin's voice that meant Beatriz must have shot him a look. The familiarity of it both comforted and tormented him.
"Now Marisita, who we have on the show tonight, was recently in the presence of a saint when darkness overtook him. That's right, isn't it, Marisita?"
"Yes,"
Marisita said. "And did you see what form his darkness took?" Marisita said,
"I'm sorry, I'm crying. May I have a minute?"
"Oh," said Diablo Diablo, sounding a little cross and a lot like Joaquin. He pulled it back together.
"Well, you have a cry? The rest of us can join you, including Elvis. Let's have a listen to Are You Lonesome Tonight?"
You can imagine the effect that this exchange had on Daniel, who was in love with Marisita. He had heard the tears in her voice, and it made tears rise up in his throat as well. It was only because he knew that he had brought only so much water with him, and could not spare it, that he did not allow himself to weep with her. The song drew to a baleful close, and Diablo Diablo's voice cut in. "And we're back. Wipe your eyes, everyone, it'll be all right, and if it won't, it'll be a good story for someone else. Marisita, are you still there?"
"I am."
"Let's try this again. Did you see Daniel's darkness?"
Daniel was as interested in this answer as his cousins were, as he had not yet seen whatever it was that he felt shadowing him. He was certain that Marisita had looked out the window after him as he left. He had been able to feel the familiar weight of her gaze wrapped around him. So it was possible she had seen whatever it was that watched him now.
"No, I did not,"
Marisita said in her sweet, sad voice.
"Nothing except for the owls. I'm sorry. I want to be able to help, but I didn't see any change at all. It's hard for me to imagine that he even had any darkness inside him, because he was, you know how he is."
Yes, they all knew how he was. But we all have darkness inside us. It is just a question of how much of us is light as well.
"Yes," Diablo Diablo said bleakly. "He was a saint."
"I didn't see him up close, though. He passed me a note through my door and told me not to come out,"
Marisita continued.
"It said he was dangerous and that I shouldn't follow him."
"Dangerous," Diablo Diablo repeated, and the word thrilled over teeth. "Did you happen to see which way Daniel went when he left?"
"I looked out the window after him. I saw him going into the night. He stopped near the edge of Bichoraro, but I don't know why.
This had been because Daniel had encountered Antonia Soria's dogs. They had not yet become aware of his presence. Some were sleeping, some were dozing warily, and yet another was worrying at what was left of Tony's white jacket. Some men